Guten Tag, and welcome to the very first episode of the German American Genealogist Podcast. You might not know it, but today is actually a national holiday. You won't be getting a day off work, you won't be getting any gifts, and you won't even find it on your calendar. And no, you didn't forget your anniversary. So what the heck is today? Well, bust out your dirndls, because today, October 6th, is German-American History Day. What better day to unveil the inaugural episode of the German American Genealogist podcast? You're probably thinking to yourself, I've never heard of German American History Day. Is this guy just making it up? No, actually, German American History Day, sometimes just called German American Day, has been celebrated in the United States since the 1800s. The holiday commemorates this day in 1683 when families from Germany sailed into Philadelphia. These families would go on to found the first German settlement in the American colonies, a town named, appropriately, Germantown, Pennsylvania. These 13 families were not the first Germans to come to the American colonies. That honor belongs to a handful of Germans who joined the English Jamestown settlement in Jamestown, Virginia, a little over 70 years earlier in 1608. However, all of those original Jamestown Germans either died, were murdered, or sailed back to Germany, meaning that they did not leave any descendants here in America. The German immigrants who came on October 6, 1683, and settled Germantown, Pennsylvania, were the first Germans to come to this country and plant permanent roots, and also potatoes. So, considering the fact that German is the number one ethnic identity in America, more so than even English or Irish, why didn't German American Day take off as a holiday and join the ranks of St. Patrick's Day or even Cinco de Mayo? Well, originally it might have. In the 1700s and 1800s, Germans, as a group, were a highly sought-after bunch of immigrants. They were seen as industrious, honest, frugal, and productive. Villages in Germany would often be blanketed with posters and advertisements trying to draw Germans to come to America, and when they got to America, they would find countless ads in newspapers from employers asking specifically for German workers because they were perceived as being so hard-working. All that prestige started to change after the outbreak of World War I, and even more so with World War II. I remember my great-grandma, who was of Danish and Scotch-Irish descent, told me that when she married her husband, my great-grandpa Schmidt, in 1935, her friends asked her, "Why'd you have to go and marry a German? Don't you know they're our enemy?" Now, by that time, my great-grandpa Schmidt was a third-generation German-American, and men in his family had fought for America in the First World War. But still, this was the mindset that a lot of German-Americans faced in the early 20th century. This made many German-Americans feel ashamed of their German heritage, and it was about this time that we lost things like German-language schools, German-language church services, clubhouses, and German-American Day. German-Americans and others who held on to their ethnic heritage were often accused of hyphenism, a slur implying that using any term other than simply American meant you weren't a 100% American. During the World War era, newspapers across the country called for German school teachers, college professors, and church pastors to be fired because there was a fear that they would indoctrinate malleable minds with propaganda from Imperial Germany. "You are feeling very sleepy." Many German town names across America were changed to more English-sounding names.
Chip, chip, cheerio.
There was even a bill in Congress in 1918 that would have required all German town names in America to be changed to something non-German. Employers were pressured to fire German-American employees. German language newspapers were shut down under the Espionage Act. A few Germans were lynched, and one German-American was even jailed under the Sedition Act for complaining about the weather in America.
Hey, Fritz, what do you think of this weather we're having?
Oh, it is terrific! Yeah, I have no complaints.
Now, this isn't to say that Germans in America ever had it anywhere near as bad as African Americans, Native Americans, or even Japanese Americans. Not that long after the dust had settled from World War I, we found ourselves electing the first U.S. president with paternal German heritage, Herbert Hoover. And following World War II, we elected another distinctly German-American president, Dwight Eisenhower. African Americans had to wait 220 years to be represented in the Oval Office, and we've still never had a self-identified Native American president or Japanese American president. Well, they say that time heals all wounds, and after a few decades, President Ronald Reagan proclaimed October 6th of 1983 to once again be German American Day. In 1987, Congress formalized the holiday with a Senate resolution, and it was signed into law. So, how exactly does one celebrate German heritage? The first thoughts that come to most people's minds are, of course, listening to oompa music and drinking beer.
Yay!
Well, of course, we all like a good lager, but here's some other ways that you can commemorate and celebrate your German heritage. And chances are you do have at least a drop of German blood in you.
Did some von Menschen blood?
You can talk to your oldest relatives, whether that's your parents or grandparents or great aunts and uncles, or whether you're lucky enough for that to be your great grandparents. Chances are decent that if your oldest living relatives weren't immigrants, they might have known and interacted with your original immigrant ancestors. That might be your link to the so-called old country. Ask them what their childhood was like, what kind of cultural identity they lived, if people acted and thought differently back then from the way they do now, and what kinds of traditions that people had in their younger days that we've lost. Ask them everything they can remember about their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and everybody in previous generations. And if just one day out of the year isn't enough German heritage for you, the entire month of October is actually called German American History Month. I'm celebrating German American History Month by sharing on my blog at schmidtgen.com one little helpful tip every day for researching your German heritage. For instance, this past week, I've posted about how you need to be careful when you're researching ancestors in Germany because Germans tended to recycle names from a relatively small pool of choices.
Hey, honey, I got this new baby name book. Let's see here. The first page says boys' names, Johann or Konrad. Okay, the next page, girls' names, Anna or Margareta. And that's it. That's the whole book.
This was not because they were uncreative or unimaginative when naming their babies. It was because, in old Germany, babies were named after their baptism sponsor. Therefore, you might have a whole village full of boys named Johann Conrad and girls named Anna Margareta. And just because you find two documents both referring to a Johann Conrad from the same town, it doesn't mean they're referring to the same person. You've really got to pay careful attention to the exact birth dates and the parents' names of each person, because when you're researching German ancestors, that's really the only way to be completely sure that you haven't accidentally combined two individuals.
It's alive! It's alive!
Moreover, due to the fact that half the population of a German village might have had the first name of Johannes or Anna, middle names became very important in German culture. So much so that a lot of Germans preferred to go by their middle name. One family household might have children named Johann Adam, Johann Peter, Johann Zacharias, Johann Balthasar, Johann Conrad, Johann Karl, Johann Dieter. You get the point. A lot of times, it made sense for people to just use their middle name, or to even switch their name around later in life. So their middle name was first, and their first name was second. And here's another tip. Don't worry too much about the spelling of German names. Especially prior to the 1900s, a lot of people in Germany couldn't even write their names. They would just sign with their mark, which might be an X or a cross. So if you find a record for a Conrad spelled with a C, and another record for a Conrad spelled with a K, don't automatically assume that they're different people. Germans in the pre-20th century era spelled their names and the names of towns phonetically. As long as it was pronounced correctly, the spelling was acceptable.
You will write your name 100 times on the blackboard until you have it right!
School teachers in old Germany might have disagreed, but for the most part, that was the way that people functioned. This is why you sometimes hear those stories about how, when people emigrated from Europe to America in the 1900s, two brothers might end up with differently spelled surnames. Another thing you'll notice in old German records is that people used to prefix their name with their job title. Also, they would capitalize the first letter of their occupation, because in the German language, nouns are always capitalized. So, if you see this in a German record, don't just assume that the first capitalized word is part of their given name. You might see a record that mentions Taglehner Johann Brock. His first name isn't Taglehner. That is a word that means day laborer, indicating what Johann Brock did for a living. Females also often had job titles in front of their name. You might see a record for Taglehnerin Margaretha Schuchart. Taglehnerin is the female version of day laborer, so the English translation for that would be day laborer Margaretha Schuchart. One of my favorite resources for translating and deciphering these occupation titles is a book called The German-English Genealogical Dictionary by Ernest Thode. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, but it's spelled T-H-O-D-E. Ernest's book contains hundreds of German words for occupations, including some really rare ones that might otherwise stump you if you're trying to translate a German document. If you're really itching to dig into your German roots, here's a couple neat websites you can visit. The first one is a database called Hessian Troops in America that lists the names of Hessian mercenaries who fought in the American Revolution, mostly on the side of the British. This database is offered by Philipps University Marburg in Marburg, Germany, and you can find it on their website at uni-marburg.de. If your German language skills are rusty, you can find a link to the exact database page on my blog at schmidtgen.com/wordpress, and it's under the heading German Genealogy Tip Number 3. This database is really incredible because you might find you had a German ancestor who was in America back in the 1700s and then went back to Germany, and their descendants might not have immigrated to America permanently for another 100 years. The Hessian Troops in America database gives you the names and hometowns of the mercenaries and gives you dates for when each soldier was recruited, appointed, transferred, took leave, died, and/or deserted. And by deserted, of course, I'm not talking about a slice of cake and a scoop of sorbet. I mean that many of these Hessian mercenaries used their military recruitment as a ticket to the land of opportunity in America. Many Hessian mercenaries, after being taken as prisoners of war, were given jobs on American farms. A lot of them were even offered land bounties if they would desert the British and join the Americans, and a lot of them accepted that offer. Another one of my favorite resources for doing German genealogy is a website called genealogy.net. It's a German website and it includes tons of absolutely free information, such as a section called Grabsteine, which lists hundreds of German gravestones, an amazing collection of historic address books dating back into the 1800s, and something called the GED BAS database. The GED BAS database includes family history data that mainly German genealogists have uploaded to the website. These German researchers may have gotten their data from small village church parish books and other little-known sources that are not yet available online. When you find a file for a pertinent ancestor in this database, scroll to the bottom of the page to see the name and email address of the German researcher who uploaded that data. You can then contact that researcher for more information on that ancestor or that village. That researcher may have close access to the original church records for that town. I'm going to be posting a new German genealogy research tip every day on my blog at schmidtgen.com for all of German American History Month this October. So come back to the blog every day to get your fix. And that's schmidtgen.com. Now, I've talked a bit in this episode about using new technology and websites to help you with your German genealogy research. But there's a guy who is an, shall we say, uber expert when it comes to using technology to hack genealogy. His name is Thomas McKenty, and you are in for a real treat because this guy knows his stuff, and he is at the forefront of just about every frontier in the genealogy industry. We're going to be talking to Thomas right after the break, so stay tuned. If you would like to advertise on the German American Genealogist podcast, please click the Advertise with Us link in the podcast section on schmidtgen.com. Since we're such a young podcast, we have some really affordable prices if you would like an ad for your product or service to be featured in one of our episodes. Your advertisement will continue to pay dividends because these podcasts are archived. And everyone who goes back to listen to an older episode will continue to hear your advertisement. Contact us today to get started. Okay, I'm here today with Thomas McKenty. Thomas McKenty is one of the most well-known and accomplished consultants and researchers in the genealogy industry. Thomas gives lectures, does market analysis, entrepreneur coaching. He writes many great blogs, including genealbloggers.com. He runs a genealogy business called High Def Genealogy at highdefgen.com and has published about a dozen books, including Family History Trippin', A Guide to Planning a Genealogy Research Trip, Preserving Your Family's Oral History and Stories, and he's published guides to doing genealogy research in Illinois, New York, and New Jersey. Just to name a few. Thomas, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, Thomas, you're in Chicago, but that's not where you're originally from, is it?
No, I grew up in upstate New York, known as the Catskills, which is pretty broad. It goes from the western part to the eastern part. I grew up in about 100 miles northwest of New York City, a very small town of 5,000 people that was traditionally a Jewish resort area in the 50s and 60s.
5,000 people. Now, I live in a town of about 3,000 people, so I might have you beat there. But what would you do for fun in a town of only 5,000 people?
Well, everything, you know, I was kind of a nerd. I was very academic. To me, schoolwork, library, all of that history. The history is a lot of history in New York. And I was really blessed that my mother would take my brother and I around to different places. My ancestors were Huguenot, and they helped settle Ulster County and Dutchess County in New York, which is closer to the Hudson River over east of where I grew up. So for me, fun, though, was anything that was history-related.
Now, McKenty as a last name, that sounds Scottish or Irish, I would assume.
There's a story behind that. Actually, the original name is McKenty, M-C, E-N-T-E-E. My great-great-grandfather changed the name. He added the A around 1900 so that he could find work as an Irishman. There was a bias towards not hiring the Irish. So I've been actually, that was a family story that I was able to prove through my research. And my McKentys have been in New York since about 1800. They were salt merchants, and they settled in Saline, New York, which is up near Syracuse.
Now, who is the most interesting ancestor of yours that you have ever discovered?
My most interesting is the one that really launched me on genealogy. His name is Johannes Putman, P-U-T-M-A-N, also spelled P-O-O-T-M-A-N, known as Jan Putman. He arrived in Schenectady in 1661 from the Netherlands. He and his wife were killed during the Schenectady raid of 1680, where it was part of the French and Indian Wars. So it was his story that captivated me in a printed genealogy that my family had done in 1916. And it was more than just the names and dates. They actually told the whole story of how he and his wife were killed, how the children were captured and taken over to Canada. I visited the spot where he is buried with 25 other people that were killed during the raid. And I've gone through that whole historical area of Schenectady. So that is really my ancestor that draws me in. And that I have focused quite a bit on.
Was there a specific moment in your life when you really caught the genealogy bug, so to say?
Yeah, I'm going to date myself here. It was actually in 1977. I was watching Roots, the miniseries, watching it with my great-grandparents. My great-grandparents helped raise me. They were a big influence in my life. And so after, of course, each episode was over, conversation would turn to family history. But even being raised by them, you know, that is what entertainment was. Family history was entertainment in the living room. We would tell stories. I would ask questions about where our families came from. And really, I didn't get to put that interest into action until really the early 1990s.
Now, where did you go to college, and what was your college experience like?
I went to college at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. My freshman year was 1980. It's actually when President Reagan was shot. So I was on campus during that whole incident. And I focused on art history as a major, Spanish literature and language as a minor. The reason is I wanted a good liberal arts education. I didn't want the stigma of a general studies degree. So art history really encompassed, you know, politics, philosophy. I mean, the electives that I took were just amazing. And I was lucky to be at GW at the time that I was. It was just when it was coming into national prominence, as a university. And, so I love being in Washington, D.C. as well.
And what was your first job that you got right out of college?
First job was working for the United States Department of Agriculture, not related to my major. It was a basic administrative position. But what happened, I was working in an education division called the Graduate School. It sounds kind of cryptic, but it started in the 30s the USDA was offering courses for people to improve their skill sets. It was early adult education. And they did it so well that other branches of the government ended up sending their people there. So they marketed that, and they marketed even outside the federal government. So I was a program manager. I would make sure that, you know, set up courses. And then one day they brought in an IBM PC, and they threw it on my desk, and they said, here, you have the first one in the department. I had one of the first ones in all of USDA. And they said, here, learn it and teach everyone else. So I became what I call the accidental trainer, and that is actually what led to my career in information technology.
And how did you pivot from that into a full-time genealogy business?
Well, I spent about 25 years in the IT field, mostly working for large global law firms around the world, 2,000 attorneys, 17 offices, multiple languages. I was managing projects and also was a Microsoft Office application instructor for Excel, Word, and PowerPoint. And then I got laid off in 2008 and during the Great Recession as it just started to take off. And I knew that jobs were not coming back for guys in my age range. I was in my late 40s then. And still a lot of my colleagues that I work with are not fully employed or they're in different fields. So I took my technical skills. I could see what was going on in the genealogy industry. I could tell that there were changes afoot. Who do you think you are was just coming on television. Social media was taking off. Facebook was really taking off. And I realized that I could make a career out of being in the genealogy space with my own business.
How do you think technology at genealogists' disposal has changed between, say, the 1990s and now?
Oh, it's actually internet years. I think every one calendar year is the equivalent of 6 years, or every one internet year. I don't know what the ratio is. I mean, it goes by leaps and bounds. I mean, I remember, you know, getting online in the 90s with Prodigy and bulletin board services and Hayes modems and everything. It's light years. One of the biggest things right now is that geography is no longer our master. That is what technology has really solved, and social media and being online. Examples are, I can do a lookup request on Facebook now, whereas I used to have to put it in Everton's newsletter, or I would have to go out on a bulletin board, or I'd have to go to a meeting and post it maybe on a bulletin board and wait. You know, we have groups in Facebook right now. There's groups like Technology for Genealogy. I run a group called Evernote Genealogists, where someone can put in a request for help, and we're talking instantaneous information. We're also seeing more and more queries. Someone could say, I need help with German fraktur, handwriting or print, and there's even a genealogy translation group of people that will help you translate documents. So this is what I'm saying, is that before a platform like Facebook, you would have to use other means and mechanisms to make this happen, and it was much slower. So I think we really can benefit from that.
You mentioned Evernote in your comments. Could you explain what that is?
Yeah, Evernote is, if you want to think of a virtual assistant, if you had a personal assistant that worked online, Evernote is a tool that lets you collect information that you come across in your day. So I can clip an article from the web and save it for offline reading. This is great for those of us that have 30 tabs open on our web browser that crashes. So now when I see an article, I hit my clip button. It goes into Evernote. I can tag it, and I can then read it while I'm waiting at the airport for a flight, or maybe while I'm a second screener watching TV. I will often read articles during commercials. So Evernote is great. I also use it for reminders. I can scan photos or scan documents and send them to Evernote. More and more genealogists are using Evernote as their research log to track their research.
30 tabs on my internet browser is probably a little conservative for me, so that might be something I need to look into. How did we genealogists ever function without all these digital resources we have now?
Well, I think back then the information, the amount of information was not as accessible as it is now. Everything can, I don't want to say everything can be, but so much of it is at our desktop, and also mobile now, is that it's very easy to feel overwhelmed, information overload. I fight that every day. I get 300 to 400 emails a day. And in order to manage those emails, it takes some skills, some triage, some labeling and categorization. I'm a very intense project manager. Everything I do, even this interview, Josiah, is on my project management schedule. And so I will track how much time I've spent on it. And this way it reminds me of things. You need to have tools, and the tools are out there. Many of them are free. Like Evernote. Evernote has a free version that can help you stay on top of information so that you don't feel overwhelmed and can manage it.
How do you manage your schedule throughout the day? Do you have your own system?
I do, actually. You know, I use an Excel spreadsheet, and it serves me well. I do have a site called hackgenealogy.com where you can go and watch a video about my project management system and download the template for free and use the Excel spreadsheet yourself. So let's say when you asked me to do this interview, I put it in there as a row, as an entry, and I have the date down, and I colored it yellow because yellow are pending projects. And when we're done with this call, I will mark it as green. I will move it to a completed worksheet, an area that I call completed, and then I will allot the amount of time. The time is important because as a professional genealogist, let's say you're a client researcher, you need to track your time. Also, tracking my time helps me know at the end of the day, where did my day go? If you're ever sitting there saying, okay, where did the day go? I can now look and say, okay, I spent an hour on email. I spent an hour doing this project and that project. So I'm a little bit OCD. Actually, I contend that most genealogists are OCD. I think you have to be in this field. I play a lot OCD. And so everything gets scheduled. At any one time, I could have 50 projects on that master, project management sheet. And it's just a way to do it.
Do you ever do any consulting with other people who are trying to run genealogy businesses and help them get on top of their schedule and make sure that they're maximizing what they get out of their time?
Yeah, I do do that. And I've tried to do mentoring as well. Unfortunately, my time is at a premium as it is now. I work about 11 hours a day. My day usually starts about 8 o'clock and then, ends at 6 p.m., dinner, time with family, and then back on the clock, usually about 10 o'clock at night. And so I've had to charge for that. So I don't call it mentoring. When I charge for it, it's coaching. And I do help people. I do help people get their businesses set up, manage their day, point out tools, market their skills, add new products and services. So I do this not just for individuals. I've also done it for startup companies. Startup companies come into the genealogy industry and they don't know anything about our demographic. They don't know what our pressure points are, what our irritation points are, what products we like, et cetera. So I've been able to capitalize upon that. I'm a big proponent of selling your knowledge, your expertise.
What are some of the most interesting and exciting startups that you're working with right now?
Actually, I've taken a little bit of a break. Some that I've seen lately, Saving Memories Forever is a application for iPhone and for mobile devices that helps you record family stories and preserve them. I think that's the area that we're seeing the most startups right now, storytelling. The other one that I'm looking at right now, let's see, I've got one here on my list that I review products all the time. So I do that quite a bit. So anything really dealing with storytelling for a review, StoryWorth is another one. Story, WORTH. You sign up for free and they send you a story prompt once a week. You can actually then pull in a family member to help write that story. I think with the baby boomers, which is my demographic, Nostalgia is very popular. To example, today's the 55th anniversary of the debut of the Twilight Zone on television. And the minute you say Twilight Zone to me, it brings back all these memories of my favorite episodes, etc. So a lot of the startups that I'm seeing are capitalizing on nostalgia, on memories, and preservation of those stories and memories.
You wrote a book about preserving your family's oral history. How does technology play into that?
Well, the new programs can cut both ways. I think with anything digital, it becomes, everyone thinks that digital is all great and everything, but you know, it's very easy to delete a file. It is. It's so easy to delete a file, and then that file is gone. So the nice thing with digital, though, is we're seeing more and more services that will convert your old 8mm movies, your videos, your VCR tapes. They will scan your photos. Services will let you put 2,000 photos in a box and charge you a flat rate to scan them all and send you them back on a CD or a DVD. That's the exciting part. But none of that, for all the technology that we have, that's not going to serve us unless we have a commitment to sit down with our family members, especially our older family members, and interview them and get this information out of them. There's a West African proverb that says when an elder dies, it's the same as having a library burned down. There's that base of knowledge that just goes away. There are things that about me growing up and about my great grandmothers. Take my niece and nephew, for instance. My niece and nephew in Virginia Beach, they never met my great grandparents. I am the bridge. I am the connector with those people that were born in the late 1890s. The only way my niece and nephew will ever know them are through the stories that I've been able to preserve. And I think that's really our role as family historians and genealogists. Also, as a business owner, that is what we can offer to our clients, going beyond just the research angle. Now you've got your research. Now what are you going to do with it?
You also wrote a book on pinning your family history. And perhaps a lot of genealogists don't exactly know what Pinterest is. Can you explain what Pinterest is and how you can use that to help you with your genealogy research?
Yeah, well, Pinterest, jokingly, is what I call the crack of the internet. It is it is where, you know, time can easily get sucked away. And what I was seeing, I started on Pinterest about January 2013. And like anything I take up, I do my research before I jump in. And I was noticing, you know, that people were pinning. What they do when you pin is you create like a bulletin board, a virtual bulletin board, and you say, I'm going to collect all these little things about one topic. So I could do maybe history of the Catskills in New York, and I would find photos and I would find articles and I could pin them. And in a way, it's you're curating information. That is all Pinterest is. The nice thing is Pinterest has become the number three website for leader for website traffic, number one being Google, number two being Facebook. So Pinterest is a big source of my traffic. Also, the demographic on Pinterest is mostly women from 35 to 55. And, you know, from a market standpoint, those are the people that are making purchasing decisions. They will go out and buy a new something related to preserving memories, something related to family history. So that's key as well. But what I do on a typical day is I will find something related to my family history. It's got to be image-driven, so there has to be an image related to it. And then I will pin it to one of my boards. I even have a board called 50 Shades of Genealogy. And what it is I look for fun and quirky products related to genealogy. So Pinterest is just a way. It's also, Josiah, for me lately, it's become more of a way for me to remember something, sort of like an Evernote, a visual Evernote. I just ran across an article today, and I thought, you know, I want to come back to this, so I'll pin it to this board. I even have a board called Genealogy Reading List, which is articles from local newspapers where they highlight a genealogy society or maybe something going on with a cemetery or some type of project. So Pinterest is very addictive. If you've not been on it before, But that's been part of my role in the genealogy community. Most people would not think of using Pinterest for genealogy. I've actually built ancestor timelines for my ancestors, where I will tell their story in a timeline format on Pinterest. And the reach of Pinterest is incredible because it's very easy for people to share information.
You had mentioned that Facebook was actually the number two driver of web traffic. And most people might think of Facebook as just being the home of Candy Crush and Farmville. But how can genealogists actually take advantage of this immense social network?
I think what you've got to be focused. I make it very clear to family members and to friends that I'm only on Facebook to discuss genealogy. I have jokingly told people, if you invite me to play Farmville, I will come and burn down your crops. and I have outright said that. You know, I don't do games, and so I'm very narrow in focus. I have 2,000 friends on Facebook, which seems kind of phenomenal, but they're all genealogists. They're genealogists that I've met when I speak at conferences or that I've heard my webinars. So I have built sort of a LinkedIn version of a social network around genealogy. And then I leverage that. I share information. I get my ideas for future products and services by having my ear to the rail, and that rail is Facebook. When I see people complaining that it's difficult to do this or I need help doing that, that's where I get my inspiration. Facebook is all it is. It's a platform of information. You have to be creative in the way that you leverage it.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you are a prolific blogger, and I think that might be a bit of an understatement. Exactly how many blogs do you run currently?
Oh, that I admit to? Let me see. I think that I have about 6 that are very active. I have 13 at least. GeniaBloggers.com is the one where I post the most. GeniaBloggers is a community for genealogy bloggers. So there's at least one post every day. I also have High Definition Genealogy, my business site. Hack Genealogy is sort of like a life hacker for genealogy. It's a technology and genealogy mashup. The other one that I have is my personal blog is called Destination Austin Family, where I will preserve family stories and post photos. I also have a food-related blog called And I Helped, which is started out as my mother's recipes and as a way of preserving them. And so I document everything related to food and holidays and everything in my family. And so blogging has been a great outlet. I started blogging when my mother's early onset Alzheimer's was worsening. It started for her in 2000 at the age of 59. She was diagnosed very young. And my goal was to preserve all those family stories of her growing up with 11 siblings in Jersey City, New Jersey. And again, getting back to that whole idea of that knowledge being lost, I didn't want that to be lost. So, and then it just basically morphed into writing about genealogy and about my family history.
How can other genealogists use blogging to help them in their research?
Well, blogging has become the new cousin bait. And basically, this is what it is. You are your own publisher. The means of publication are no longer controlled by a small group. Publishing is very accessible. An example is we've had people start genealogy blogs. They will scan photos. They will put them up. And they will write stories. And within even just hours, they will get an inquiry from someone saying, hey, I'm so-and-so's second. Yeah, that's my second great grandfather. I think we're related. Or I'm sitting on a family Bible related to that family. So all of that information gets picked up by Google, Bing, and Yahoo, and all the major search engines. And that is the main power of blogging. But really, you should blog because you want to, because you're passionate about it, because you feel you have something to share, whether your audience is 10 people or 10 million people. But I think if you blog with passion, if you write with passion about your family history, people will find you.
How can a genealogical blogger think of something new to write about every day?
Well, that's where Genia Bloggers comes in. We have over 50 different blogging prompts. Today is Thursday. We have one called Treasure Chest Thursday, where we ask a genealogist to take an heirloom or something of value to the family and take a photo of it and write about it. Tuesday is Tombstone Tuesday, where we ask people to post a tombstone photo and tell us about the person that's buried there. So there's hundreds of them out there, different types of writing prompts, many in the genealogy community. There's a series that Amy Johnson Crow is doing called 52 Ancestors, 52 Weeks, where you take one ancestor a week and you just write. A good blog post should be about 600 words, and that's fairly easy to do for most people. I also contend that the more you write, the better your writing gets. And this has been proven. People say that, you know, they start out and their punctuation is not good, their grammar is not good. I think the more blog posts you read and the more you write, the better you become as a writer.
I think the genealogy field of today might have been unrecognizable to genealogists of 20 or 30 years ago. What do you think is the next big technological development that we're due for in the genealogy industry?
The next big technical, actually I have a new lecture that I put together called Wearables in Genealogy. I think that is where we will be in the next 5 years. Google Glass, the new smart watches, the watches that are coming out. With Google Glass, you'll be able to go up to a tombstone and get all the family history information about that person that's buried there. Another example is if you know these Fitbit bracelets, we're going to see these type of wearable bracelet or watch devices. Let's say that you have one where you can upload your DNA testing information, and maybe you're at a genealogy conference and your watch would vibrate if you're within 100 feet of a fourth cousin. Notification is going to be very popular in terms of notifying you proximity, you know, that you're near something. So I think we're going to see those types of technologies trickle down to genealogy.
Wow, the future is here. Can you tell us what's in the near future for you personally?
Personally for me, I have a very ambitious lecture schedule in 2015. I'm actually booked out until mid-2016 right now. Mostly the spring of 2015, I'll be on the West Coast. I will be at Roots Tech in Salt Lake City and FGS. And so I'll be very busy with that. I'm busy with my, I have several new ventures. One is, GenBiz Solutions, which is a series of guides targeting genealogy business owners. How to start your own genealogy business, how to do a marketing plan, how to start a business blog, et cetera. So I'm really excited about pulling in the experts in the genealogy industry and having them share their knowledge. The other one that I just started on Monday is called Genealogy Intensive. I'm noticing that while webinars are great in the genealogy community, that idea of sitting through a 50-minute lecture with a 10-minute Q&A session isn't really building our skills. So Genealogy Intensive is an online collaborative group coaching community limited to 12 people around a topic like family history writing or using a research log, and it lasts for 6 weeks. And so I'm developing these new educational products that I really think are people will get excited about, and I think we need actionable content in our genealogy education.
Where can visitors go to sign up for one of these genealogy education programs that you're hosting?
Yeah, the best place is to go to Hack Genealogy at hackgenealogy.com. I also have the URL genealogyintensive.com if you want that. And the other one is called GenBiz Solutions, GenBiz.solutions. So it's I have many different brand names. Branding has not been it's been one of those things that I sort of am in the unbrand. I make it, Josiah, on purpose. It's hard to find everything that I do. That's part of that ninja mystique. And the thing is, I prefer it that way. I really when people find me, they have to do a little work to find me, but I have to say it's going to be worth it.
Where can people go to buy all these wonderful books that you've written?
The books are available on Amazon Kindle, so you can go out to Amazon. I have an author page there. If you do want them, they are not in print. Most of my books are digital. Also, Legacy Family Tree, their store offers them in PDF format as well.
Thomas McEntee, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Great, thank you.
Your loved ones aren't going to be around forever. Have you ever wanted to sit down and ask your dad about his experience in the war, or interview your grandma to get her life story, but haven't been sure how to conduct the interview and how to ask the right questions? That's why I wrote my new book, 2000 Questions for Grandparents, Unlocking Your Family's Hidden History. 2000 Questions for Grandparents contains a manual on how to conduct family history interviews, as well as 2000 questions on such topics as childhood life, memories of previous generations, world events, outlook on life, marriage and family, career and hobbies, spirituality and politics, likes and dislikes, travels and migrations, military service, and more. Purchase 2000 Questions for Grandparents today at a special early bird discount on lulu.com. You can find a link to the book in the publications section at my website, www.schmidtgen.com. I really enjoy doing this podcast, but I also enjoy researching genealogy for other people. My professional genealogy research services are available for hire on an hourly commission basis. If you have a genealogical brick wall and you'd like to get some expert assistance, please contact me at my website, www.schmidtgen.com. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to the very first episode of the German-American Genealogist podcast. Keep your eyes and ears peeled for a new episode every Monday, and if you miss an episode, just check the podcast archive on schmidtgen.com. These episodes will also be posted to YouTube, so you can search for the German-American Genealogist podcast there as well. Join us next week as we talk to author and historian Dr. Teva Scheer about what life was like in early modern Germany for the average villager or peasant. German history often focuses on what kings and generals did, but it's hard to find out about a real day in the life of the little guy. So don't miss next week's episode. Until next time, this has been Josiah Schmidt with the German-American Genealogist Podcast. Auf Wiedersehen.